Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. As you know, we aspire to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation welcoming people of every ethnic and religious background, no matter your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, your family structure, your abilities or disabilities. No matter where you are in this journey of life, we welcome you. Now, later in the service, if you are new or this is one of your first times, if you'd like to introduce yourself, we will have a moment when you can do that. We don't force you to do that. We may all turn and look at you, but you really don't have to do it. On Sunday mornings, we have a variety of services. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, the minister here. Sometimes people from outside the congregation do the service, and sometimes people from within the congregation do it. But they're almost always different, so if this is one of your first times, we hope that you will return. These, then, are the opening words. They are the words of Unitarian Universalist Minister William Murray. These are the days that have been given to us. Let us rejoice and be glad in them. These are the days of our lives. Let us live them well in love and service. These are the days of mystery and wonder. Let us cherish and celebrate them in gratitude together. These are the days that have been given to us. Let us make of them stories worth telling to those who come after us. We light this chalice as a symbol of our thankfulness. The chalice reminds us of the sun, the giver of life. The flame rises up like the power of growth and renewal in the springtime. We give thanks for the sun, which lights and warms the earth, for the growth and renewal of nature arising from the earth and for the earth itself. The reading is actually in the back of the hymnal. If you comprehend better following along, it's number 659. 659, and last time I spoke about the Transcendentalists, I believe we did this as the responsive reading. But today I'm going to read the whole thing. This is Walt Whitman. The sum of all known reverence I add up in you, whoever you are. Those who govern are there for you. It is not you who are there for them. All architecture is what you do to it when you look at it, look upon it. All music is what awakes from you when you are reminded by the instruments. The sun and stars that float in the open air, the apple-shaped earth and we upon it, the endless pride and outstretching of people, unspeakable joys and sorrows, the wonder everyone sees in everyone else they see, and the wonders that fill each minute of time forever. It is for you, whoever you are. It is no farther from you than your hearing and sight are from you. It is hinted by nearest, commonest, readiest. We consider Bibles and religions divine. I do not say they are not divine. I say they have all grown out of you and may grow out of you still. It is not they who give the life. It is you who give the life. Will you seek afar off? You surely come back at last in things best known to you, finding the best, or as good as the best, happiness, knowledge, not in another place, but this place, not for another hour, but this hour. Ah, Whitman, singing the praises of the individual, telling us that everything we need, we can find within ourselves, urging each one of us to be the ones who interpret what is divine and what isn't, what deserves reverence from us and what doesn't. You surely come back at last, he writes, in things best known to you, finding the best, or as good as the best, happiness, knowledge, not in another place, but this place, not for another hour, but this hour. When I first encountered Whitman, my freshman year in college, I was smitten. Yes, 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 I remember was my response to his writing. I am that wonderful, that strong, that confident. I don't need anyone else telling me what to believe or what is worthy of respect or telling me, from my good Calvinist Presbyterian background, that Jesus knew about miracles, what Whitman called wonders. Wonders are everywhere. The wonder everyone sees in everyone else they see, and the wonders that fill each minute of time forever. It is not they who give the life, it is you who give the life. Oh, and then there was Song of Myself. Whew. Just what an adolescent wants to hear. Which says something. This is part two of my reflections about transcendentalism. If you were here 3 weeks ago when I did the first part, you may have been confused, or at least not completely clear, about what exactly transcendentalism is. That's okay, so was I. I'm going to start now with a brief recap of what I was trying to do in part one. I told you then that even the transcendentalists were confused about who they were. And I'm always using a capital T here, the word transcendentalist and the word transcendentalism. When, the transcendentalists had trouble, as much trouble as we do, trying to define the word. When Emerson tried to define transcendentalism in an essay and then in lecture form, spoken form, he only made things worse. His essay on the subject was too abstract, too obtuse. One of the best attempts at a very short definition of transcendentalism that I have found is simply this. Transcendentalism transcends, goes beyond all other ways of knowing things. You're transcendentalist, you intuit things. You don't depend on your senses, you don't depend on science, you don't depend on experience. All those things are important, but you intuit. You know in your gut certain things. So what I hope you took away from that first part, or take away today, is at least some of the following. Transcendentalism is a very important part of Unitarian Universalist history. It was one of our biggest controversies. It was controversial not just within the Unitarian congregations, and mostly, as I said 3 weeks ago, I'm talking about the Unitarians, not so much the Universalists, although they became transcendentalists eventually. It was controversial among society at large. People were frightened by transcendentalist ideas because the eminent transcendentalists such as Ralph Waldo Emerson and Theodore Parker and Thoreau, although he didn't have as big of an audience at first, they all attacked the established religions of the day, including Unitarianism. Transcendentalism was first and foremost a religious revolution. A spiritual revolution, a new way of thinking about what it means to be human, what God is or is not. It was a new way of considering such questions as, what is the ground of all being? What matters most? What is divine or awe-inspiring? How and what should we worship? And I know that many of you struggle with that word. But in this context, I mean, what is worthy of our attention? That's what I mean by worship right now. Who interprets the divine? Each individual, or the Pope, or some bishop, or the minister? Transcendentalist ideas were not new. They were presented in a different way, but they were what we might call universal truths that resurface periodically in human history until they get distorted or squashed or brutally squelched over and over again. Think ISIS. These ideas, these universal truths, demand peace as a way of being, not war. They include figuring out how to bring an end to human suffering, or at least the pain and suffering that we humans inflict upon each other. The Transcendentalist movement stated these so-called old ideas in new ways, or they tried to state them differently. But for some reason, or reasons that I have never understood, humans need to be reminded periodically about these things, about the highest ideals that humanity aspires to. But here's one thing that was new, probably, that the Transcendentalists gave us. In the words of David Robinson in his book, The Unitarians and the Universalists, Transcendentalism stands at the turning point in American life when moral questions, began to resolve themselves into political ones. Think about that. When moral questions began to resolve themselves into political ones. This continues to be an issue in the politics of our country. Is it good? Is it bad to have moral questions part of politics? Well, I don't think you can separate them. The Transcendentalists bequeath to us two beliefs that we Unitarian Universalists now take for granted. In fact, we'd probably roll our eyes to think that we would believe these things. One, every single person has a spark of the divine within them. Every person. We are all Jesus, different guys. We are all Gandhi. And maybe we are all Hitler. I don't know about that one. The second thing is, each one of us intuitively knows what truth is. And I'm using truth with a capital T here. We just know certain things in our gut. We aren't necessarily aware of the fact that we have this knowledge within us. And more often than not, we seem completely unaware of the implications of this knowledge. We Unitarian Universalists today in the 21st century rarely think about these two beliefs or truths. We take them for granted. But believe me, these are still very controversial statements. So what are the implications? If I have the divine spark, and I believe that you also have it, well, even better, I know without a doubt, because I just know it in my gut, I intuit it, that you also have divinity within you, what are the implications? How should I treat you? I guess you could say that the Transcendentalists gave us another way of looking at the golden rule. The challenge that the Transcendentalists faced in the 1800s was how to put this intuition into practice, which brings me to the tensions within Transcendentalism. Here's a quote to illustrate what I'm trying to explain. I'm indebted to one of you, you know who you are, for sending me this article on the internet, and I'm always a little wary of using things from the internet. This one doesn't seem to be attributed to anybody, except the title is Transcendentalism, a Historical Context. Here's the quote. Some Transcendentalists were led by their belief in the divinity of humankind to espouse an uncompromising individualism. Well, there were various terms to describe this individualism, and not all of them were flattering. Elizabeth Peabody called it egotheism. She'd like to tell Emerson he was guilty of egotheism. Some nicer ways to describe it were self-culture, self-reliance, which of course Emerson championed. Thoreau was a disciple or an adherent of this uncompromising individualism. After all, he didn't pay his taxes. And then, of course, there was Civil Disobedience, his wonderful essay written in 1849. And he wouldn't pay that poll tax because he didn't want the money used for the Mexican War, thus bringing Texas into the Union and more slave states into the Union. So that's one side of this, what I'll call a balance beam, or maybe a teeter-totter, of the tensions among transcendentalists. Here's the other. Some transcendentalists emphasize the unity of humankind and stressed cooperation rather than individualism as a key to social improvement. Now, you might not recognize as many of the transcendentalists who came down firmly on this side of the equation as you would, of course, recognize Emerson's name and Thoreau's, although Thoreau kind of, he was kind of both. Margaret Fuller, I think most of you know who Margaret Fuller is, a close friend of Emerson's, and actually some say that Emerson stole a lot of his ideas from her. But Margaret seemed to be able to do both, balance the self-improvement with the going out into society and trying to improve the world. I mentioned Orestes Brownson 3 weeks ago, just because I really like his name. Orestes, first name, Brownson. He began his professional career as a Unitarian minister, but he ended up as a Catholic, and he was raised as a Presbyterian Calvinist, but when he was still a young man, an adolescent, he became a Universalist. So he's important to us today because of his persistent advocacy for the working class. He, and to use a Robinson quote again, Brownson argued that political reform has to precede self-culture. That, in fact, the possibility of self-culture was dependent, this is Brownson's quote, dependent on a general reform of property distribution. So we couldn't have the, and I agree with this, you couldn't have the leisure time to self-improve until things were equal in a socioeconomic way. Brownson thought, actually, then, that the complete opposite of what Emerson was saying. And Brownson was a socialist, a communist, small c, in the early 1830s and 40s, 1840s, way ahead of his time. Speaking of communism with a small c, George Ripley's name might be familiar to some of you, because of the Brook Farm community that he started, the utopian community. Louisa May Alcott's father, Amos Bronson, started, I love the name of this one, Fruitlands, another experimental communist would-be utopian community. Now, you could say that, well, all of these communities failed, which eventually they did, but the mere fact that they existed for a while and that humans could even conceive of such experiments was a success of sorts, I think. It is important to remember, though, that of all, every single one of the transcendentalists, no matter which end of the scale they most favored, improving oneself or improving society, every single one of them was opposed to slavery, war, and what they termed the evils of capitalism. Here's an interesting aside. When I was typing in, keying in the hymn number 44, I didn't realize it, but I had the cap locks on. Do you know what the four is? It's the dollar sign. So I had number $$ instead of number 44. I thought that was pretty appropriate, though, given what the transcendentalists thought about the materialism in this country. The transcendentalists did not like the direction in which the United States was going. Does this sound familiar? See, we haven't outgrown them. They were contending with the same things we are contending with: wars, prisons in need of so much reform, the mistreatment of Native Americans, the fear of immigrants, and on and on. In the 1800s, though, they believed that this would end fairly soon, that there would be an end of slavery. Well, they were right on that one, kind of. The end of poverty. There would be a place where everyone, this would be, this country, would be a place where everyone would receive free education and thus reach their full human potential. A world in which if you are special and holy and divine, which we all are, it doesn't matter if you are mentally ill or what color your skin is or how much money you make. This really sounds familiar. Those ideas aren't old-fashioned at all. By the middle of the 1800s, so within two or three decades, transcendentalist ideas were becoming more and more accepted, not exactly mainstream yet, except perhaps among Unitarians. So much of their energy went, of course, into the anti-slavery fight. So everything else they were working on sort of got put aside until the Civil War was over. And after the Civil War, the pendulum swung to Emerson's side. As Philip Goura says in his book, American Transcendentalism, the uneasy balance between the parties of self and of society tipped in the direction of the former, that's the proponents of self-culture, whose philosophy supported individual rights and market capitalism rather than humanitarian socialism, which I think was a really sad thing for this country. In other words, Emerson's self-reliance became paramount in our national consciousness. And I think you can argue that's still the case, and I don't think it's helped this country at all. Think NRA. That's where rugged individualism has taken us. I do want to say, though, that Emerson, I bash him a lot, and I have said many times that his emphasis on self-reliance has harmed this country because it led to rugged individualism. It's all entwined. But I don't know if Emerson would approve, for lack of a better word, of where rugged individualism has taken us. He didn't take it there. His followers and descendants of spiritual descendants did. And I need to admit that I am indebted deeply to Emerson in one very important respect. I agree with him about nature and how it provides a direct experience of the divine. That's my divinity, nature, being out there. I'm going to give you just a couple of examples of what happened with the Transcendentalists in the after the Civil War. And remember that Emerson, born in 1803, lived until 1882. So he was the spokesperson for Transcendentalism through most of the 19th century. And he was certainly an influence on the second generation of Transcendentalists, and he earned that. Consider the story, though, of someone you've probably never heard of, William Batchelder Green, born in 1819, died in 1878. He's a wonderful example of Transcendentalism being the taking off point for its changing society. This man, Green, was yet another Orthodox Calvinist who couldn't live with Calvin's version of humanity. So Green became, like Bronson, a champion of the working class. Green believed that equal amounts of labor should receive equal pay. Very radical for the mid to late 1800s. Maybe still is. He also believed that mutual love, this is his quote, was the only response to what the Industrial Revolution had created, and that as soon as one made his, let me sexist language here, own private enjoyment the main end of his life, both the harmony of the universe and the unity of the human race shattered into as many fragments as there were individual men, and these fragments repelled each other, for each was intensely selfish, and each cared for his own and not for the common good. I think he was on to something, meaningful and something important. Dorothea Dix, you will have heard of, born in 1802, lived till 1887. Did you know that she ran away from home at age 12? She started a school at age 14. She was influenced by William Ellery Channing, whom many call the father of American Unitarianism. Channing suggested that Dorothea Dix start a class in her school for poor children, and she did. which led her eventually to teaching a class in a prison, which led her to realizing that there were a lot of mentally ill people in prison and they shouldn't be there. And, well, you know the rest of the story, probably. I think she found her life's work. Then there was Caroline Healy Dahl. Probably never heard of her, huh? 1822 to 1912. At age 19, she was a full participant in those conversations that Margaret Fuller had. I mean, you had to be really bright to follow what Margaret Fuller was saying. Most people fell asleep, apparently. And they were for women only, which was very unusual. But Caroline Healy Dahl never fell asleep. There was an 1841 conversation about mythology, and Caroline said that she never had enjoyed anything as much. Her husband disappeared on her in 1855 and went to Calcutta to be a missionary, and he never really returned. So there was Caroline left with the children. But she became a successful writer and lecturer. She's way ahead of her time. She wrote a book about the complex connections among systems of education, labor, and law that kept women subordinate. She was way too radical for Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, so she never managed to penetrate that inner circle. Some of you may know that Margaret Fuller, as I said, she seemed to be able to balance improving herself with trying to improve society. Some of you may know that she spent some time in New York City, and she visited prisons there, the women prisoners at Sing Sing. Women did not go into prisons to visit, but she managed to do this. Margaret was very concerned about the homeless, people living on the streets in New York City, talking 1840 here, and in what they then called almshouses. And Margaret Fuller believed that the economic social conditions were as much of a problem as skin color and or gender, if not more so. She was onto something too. I don't think we've grasped that yet. Most of these transcendentalists lived through the Civil War. Margaret Fuller, unfortunately, did not. But they continued, despite living through something as horrendous as the Civil War, they continued to believe that people could change, that the world could become a better, fairer place. Now, surely, if they could feel that way and keep their hopes up and their dreams and aspirations through that period of time, we can too, through this one. Did transcendentalism fail? Well, Philip Guru, in that book, somewhere in this building, about American transcendentalism, concludes this wonderful book saying they did fail. But I don't agree at all. I think that's an unfair judgment. No matter how utopian and idealistic they were, much of what they struggled to achieve is now a reality. And I don't mean just the theological part that we Unitarian Universalists embrace, but in other faith traditions embrace some of that. I mean the end of slavery in this country and in other parts of the world. I know there's still slavery in the world, but they did achieve that, not just the transcendentalists, but that was part of what they were trying to achieve. Yes, they lost some battles, but did they lose the war? If the war is to create fully equal society, fully egalitarian brotherhood, as they put it. I don't think so. We still have the civil rights movement. I would argue that we are nowhere done with the civil rights struggle and that we've now entered a new phase with all of these inexplicable, horrible shootings that keep happening, but it's still there. We didn't just sit down and say, we're not going to try to do this anymore. You could say the same thing about the battle for the immigrants' rights or women's rights, gay rights. Transgender rights. We're not done. We haven't eradicated racism by any means, but we're still working on it, still working towards that. And we get that from all of it's called the cloud of witnesses sometimes, but all of these people who've come before us who have worked on this, especially the transcendentalists. I find this encouraging, energizing, and uplifting, looking back at what our spiritual ancestors faced and how they dealt with the problems of their times. So I'm finished, except a word about the hymns and the next reading. I've already said that in that opening hymn, I find the words difficult to decipher. I don't know if that's my 20th, 21st century mind, but the second one, that was good and reminded me of why I liked Emerson. Now, we're going to do a responsive reading, another Whitman poem. But he's not talking about the individual being alone in this. He's talking about companions who are on the road together. Whoever you are, come travel with me, he's going to tell us. And then the closing hymn, which was written by, no, not Emerson. Do you know this person, Jane Laurie Borthwick? She wrote the words to the closing hymn. I don't know her either, but the dates of her life, which you'll see on the page where the hymn is, 1813 to 1897. So she most likely knew about transcendentalism, and she probably was a transcendentalist. So when we get to that closing hymn, those words will tell us all we need to know about how idealistic the transcendentalists were. We hardly need the closing words after that, but here they are. Reminded that we are part and participants of the universe, let us go forth from the quiet of this hour, encouraged to strive toward faithfulness to the best in ourselves, in others, and in all of creation. Go in peace. Greet your neighbors.